Marcone was still a black hat. The pain and suffering of the criminal state he ruled accounted for an untold amount of human misery. Maybe he'd been doing it for a noble reason. I could understand that. But it didn't change anything. Marcone's good intentions could have paved a new lane on the road to hell. But damn it, I couldn't hate him anymore. I couldn't hate him because I wasn't sure that I wouldn't have made the same choice in his place. Hate was simpler. But the world ain't a simple place. It would have been easier to hate Marcone. I just couldn't do it. A few days later, Michael threw a cookout as a farewell celebration for Sonia, who was heading back to Europe now that the shroud had been returned to Father Forthill. I was invited, so I showed up and ate about 150 grilled hamburgers. When I was done with them, I went into the house, but stopped to glance into the sitting room by the front door. Sonia sat in a recliner, his expression puzzled, blinking at the phone. "Again," he said. Molly sat cross-legged on the couch near him, with a phone book in her lap and my shopping list she'd picked up in the treehouse laid flat over one half of it. Her expression was serious, but her eyes were sparkling as she drew a red line through another entry in the phone book. "How strange," she said, and read off another number. Sonia started dialing. "Hello," he said a moment later. "Hello, sir. Could you please tell me if you have Prince Albert in the can?" He blinked again, mystified, and reported to Molly, "They hung up again." "Weird," Molly said, and winked at me. I left before I started choking on the laugh I had to hold back, and went out into the front yard. Little Harry was there by himself, playing in the grass in sight of his sister inside. "Heya, kid," I said. "You shouldn't be out here all by yourself. People will accuse you of being a reclusive madman. Next thing you know, you'll be wandering around saying, 'Woes, bud.'" I heard a clinking sound. Something shining landed in the grass by Little Harry, and he immediately pushed himself to his feet, wobbled, then headed for it. I panicked abruptly and lunged out ahead of him, slapping my hand down over a polished silver coin before the child could squat down to pick it up. I felt a prickling jolt shoot up my arm and had the sudden intangible impression that someone nearby was waking up from a nap and stretching. I looked up to see a car on the street, driver's side window rolled down. Nicodemus sat at the wheel, relaxed and smiling. "Be seeing you, Dresden." He drove away. I took my shaking hand from the coin. Lashiel's blackened sigil lay before my eyes. I heard a door open and, on pure instinct, palmed the coin and slipped it in my pocket. I looked back to find Sonia frowning and looking up and down the street. His nostrils flared a few times, and he paced over to stand near me. He sniffed a few more times and then peered down at the baby. "Ugh," he rumbled. "Someone is stinky." He swooped the kid up in his arms, making him squeal and laugh. "You mind if I steal your playmate for a minute, Harry?" "Go ahead," I said. "I need to get going anyway." Sonia nodded and grinned at me, offering his hand. I shook it. "It has been a pleasure to work with you," Sonia said. "Perhaps we will see each other again." The coin felt cool and heavy in my pocket. "Yeah, maybe so." I left the cookout without saying goodbye and headed home. I heard something the whole time, something whispering almost inaudibly. I drowned it out with loud and off-key singing and got to work. 10 hours later, I put down the excavating pick and glowered at the 2-foot hole I had chipped in my lab's concrete floor. The whispering in my head had segued into Sympathy for the Devil by the Stones.
"Harry," whispered a gentle voice.
I dropped the coin into the hole. I slipped a steel ring about 3 inches across around it. I muttered to myself and willed energy into the ring. The whispering abruptly cut off. I dumped 2 buckets of cement into the hole and smoothed it until it was level with the rest of my floor. After that, I hurried out of the lab and shut the door behind me. Mister came over to demand attention.
I settled on the couch, and he jumped up to sprawl on his back over my legs. I petted him and stared at Shiro's cane, resting in the corner. He said that I must live in a world of grays, to trust my heart. I rubbed Mister's favorite spot behind his right ear, and he purred in approval. Mister, at least for the moment, agreed that my heart was in the right place. But it's possible he wasn't being objective. After a while, I picked up Shiro's cane and stared down at the smooth old wood. Fidelacius's power whispered against my fingertips. There was a single Japanese character carved into the sheath. When I asked Bob, he told me that it read simply, "Faith." It isn't good to hold on too hard to the past. You can't spend your whole life looking back, not even when you can't see what lies ahead. All you can do is keep on keeping on and try to believe that tomorrow will be what it should be, even if it isn't what you expected. I took Susan's picture down. I put the postcards in a brown envelope. I picked up the jewel box that held the dinky engagement ring I'd offered her and that she'd turned down. Then I put them all away in my closet. I laid the old man's cane on my fireplace mantle. Maybe some things just aren't meant to go together. Things like oil and water, orange juice and toothpaste, me and Susan. But tomorrow was another day. This is James Marsters. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Death Masks by Jim Butcher. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse, produced by David Rapkin, and directed by Bob Walter. Death Masks is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2009, all rights reserved. The book, Death Masks, is available wherever rock books are sold.